Welcome to Pardes Daily, where you get your daily dose of Torah with Pardes faculty. This month, Pardes is bringing Elul to you. Let's dive in.
Hi, this is Rachel Berkovitz coming to you from Jerusalem. This is Unit 17 of 20, in which we're learning through all the Mishnayot of Masechet Rosh Hashanah. Yesterday, we started the fourth chapter and we read the first Mishnah, which really set up the framework of the new decrees that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai made post-temple destruction. And we saw that he did a radical move where he transferred the ritual that happened in the temple of the blowing the shofar on Shabbat and possibly blowing the shofar in general to the Beit Din. And he created a new center for religious and spiritual function as the center for the Jewish people. And this was a radical move. We are going to continue with his takanot. Mishnah Bet starts out with a kind of a shocking opening. It says, V'odzo taita Yushalayim yitira al Yavna. In Mishnah 1, we were introduced to Yavna. Yavna is the center which Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai originally built and moved the court system there from Jerusalem, the Sanhedrin, the head court there from Jerusalem. The word Yavna, you might have heard of it, still a city here in Israel. There's a Hesder Yeshiva there called Keren BeYavna. And what's interesting about the word Yavna is the root of it. Bet Nun He, Yibane, will be rebuilt. And we talked about the link between the Kiddush HaChodesh and the sanctifying the new moon and the renewal of the Jewish temple post-destruction. And we hear in the word Yavna the hope and the desire to rebuild. Now, the Mishnah opens by saying, not only in this way was Yerushalayim greater than Yavna, but, and now it's going to tell me a second way. Now, when we open with that line, that's a bit shocking because actually, in my first Mishnah, I didn't know that Yerushalayim was greater than Yavna. In fact, the whole point of the Mishnah was to tell me that in some ways I can replace Yerushalayim with Yavna. Right, Rabbi Eliezer disagreed if it was only Yavna or any Beit Din, but the Chachamim seem to say any court can sort of replace the ritual of the temple. And so though I have heard that the destruction was destructive and obviously quite painful and sad, I had thought that there was a tikkun, that there was a solution, there was a fix. And now I'm getting sort of pulled back in to let me know, lest you thought that I can just replace Jerusalem. No, Jerusalem is greater than Yavna in more ways than you one. Right. If I want to go back to the first Mishnah and find a way that it is greater, Maimonides understands the Mishnah that when it said that you could blow in the Mikdash on Shabbat, the Mikdash actually meant all of Yerushalayim and not just the temple itself. Their other Mishnah might support that read of the word Mikdash. And so then in the Mishnah number one, I saw that there's like a stickiness from the temple spreads out to all of Yerushalayim getting the holiness of the temple. Whereas Yavna itself doesn't have that stickiness. It's only in the Beit Din. And we're going to continue with this idea of stickiness as the Mishnah continued. But I've sort of been like, I was all, in some ways, you thought, oh, I can replace the Beit HaMikdash. I don't need Yerushalayim. And Mishnah 2 pulled me back to say, no. Don't think that you can be without Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim is greater than Yavna. And now here's the second reason why. Shekol ir shehi ro'ah v'shomat u'krovah v'yechola levo tok'im. That any city that can see Yerushalayim, could hear Yerushalayim, and is near enough to Yerushalayim that I can get there, I'm allowed to blow. I'm allowed to blow apparently on Shabbat, if I continue reading it that way, as the commentators do. So now I find something else out new. The stickiness that I suggested that maybe I can blow in the Mikdash and therefore I can blow in Jerusalem because Jerusalem gets its holiness from the temple itself, that can span outwards and that cities that are some ways linked, and we'll come back to this language in a moment once we finish reading the Mishnah, also can blow on Shabbat as opposed to Yavna. B'Yavna lo hayu tokim ela b'Beit Din bilvad. Whereas in Yavna, they would only blow on Shabbat in the court itself, right? The court doesn't have that same stickiness. Yavna doesn't have the same stickiness. You need to come to the court if you want to hear the shofar on Shabbat in Yavna. You can't just be in Yavna. You can't be in any city close to Yavna. And so this is a yitaron, and something that a good thing, a valuable thing that Jerusalem has on Yavna. Interestingly, if you think about this, if this is true that you can only blow in the court system, then it encourages cities to have courts. If we hold like the Rabbanim in the first Mishnah, as opposed to Rabbi Elazar, that any court you can blow in, it encouraged cities to have courts so it could enable you to blow the shofar on Shabbat if you needed to. But what is this Mishnah saying? So I think thing number one it does is tries to balance us back to remember that we had lost something by losing Yerushalayim, that Yavna, although it's a rebuilding and a renewal, there is still something lost. And this theme of trying to like bring us back every time we feel too comfortable that it's okay, that we can move past the loss of the temple, the Mishnah is going to bring us back. The second thing that I think that's really, really interesting about this Mishnah, let's talk about this stickiness that that Jerusalem has, right? So it says any town that can see and can hear and is close enough. Now, these verbs might just be verbs that sound like it means close enough, but if you look in parallel Mishnayot, if you have spare time, I suggest you look in Mishnah Megillah 1:11 and Mishnah Tamid 3:8, and you will see that these words are linked to ritual in the temple. What do I mean? Mishnah Tamid talks about that in Jericho, in Yericho, they could hear the sound of the shofar, they could smell the incense, they could hear the gates closing. Now, I don't know if this is realistic or not, but it was an experience of feeling like they were close enough to feel it. The word ro'eh appears in the Mishnah Megillah that in Shiloh, in the Mishkan, in the tabernacle, if you were on the surrounding hills and you could just see enough, you could eat from the holy, some of the holy sanctified food of the sacrifices. And the idea of being close enough is linked to some of the laws about Pesach, of doing the Paschal sacrifice. If you're close enough to Jerusalem to come, or if you need to wait till Pesach Sheni, to the alternate date. And so these are words that link the surrounding areas to the holiness, to the Temple of Jerusalem. And I think, I don't know where anyone who's listening lives, but I grew up in Brookline, Massachusetts. But if someone asked me where I was from, I said Boston, right? And that there's certain like central, right? And this is a whole argument about people who live on Long Island, if they say they live in the city or if they live in New York, right? There's certain magnet cities that even the people that live on the periphery want to feel the identity of living in the main place, right? And Jerusalem was like that. If you felt it had such a power, it had a draw that people felt connected to it, that they felt close enough to it, they felt like they were experiencing the experience of Jerusalem and could blow the shofar. And so on the one hand, this Mishnah is telling us that Yavna is not like that. It doesn't have that spiritual magnet power to draw people in. On the other hand, I think it's interesting, possibly it's suggesting to us that maybe the reasoning behind Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's ruling, that he can like move the shofar blowing to Yavna, is a feeling that people feel so connected to Jerusalem that even when they're not there, they want to feel like they're there. Right? That's the message of the Mishnah. And in some ways, by making the shofar blowing happen in Yavna, I can maybe recreate that experience a little bit, even if it's just an as if. I have the idea of, even though I'm not there, I want to feel like I'm there and I'm connected. And by blowing the shofar, it gives me that connection to remember, oh, this is how we did it in Jerusalem. This is how we did it in the temple. Okay, that's Mishnah 2. Mishnah 3. Continues with the takanot, with the decrees that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said. Berishona haya lulav nitav mikdash shiva ubemidina yom echad. At first, in the beginning, the lulav, the four species on Sukkot, was taken in the mikdash, in the temple, for 7 days. And in the Medina, and here we have that juxtaposition of those two locations that we had in Mishnah number one, and in the country, in the rest of the province, only for 1 day. And this seems to be based on verses in Leviticus, in Vayikra 23:40, that says, "Ulakachtum lachem b'yom harishon," you should take for you on the first day, and then it lists the four species. And then at the end of the thing, it's at the end of the verse, it says, "Usamachtum lifnei Hashem shivat yamim," and you should rejoice in front of the Lord 7 days. So it says 1 day and 7 days. So what's the difference between 1 day and 7 days? 1 day is everywhere, but if you're lifnei Hashem, if you're in front of Hashem, i.e. in the temple, then you take the lulav for 7 days. So normally before the destruction, if you were outside of the temple, you took the lulav only as a mitzvah on the first day. In the temple itself, they celebrated with the joy of the lulav for 7 days of Sukkot. Mishacharav Beit HaMikdash, when the temple was destroyed, Hitkin, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, same terminology, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai decreed, Shie lulav nital b'midina shiva, zechar l'mikdash, that they would take the lulav for 7 days in the Medina, right? Not in the temple, but in the regular, outside of the temple, anywhere in Israel and anywhere now in the world for 7 days. And that's what we do. We think, well, you shake the lulav for 7 days. But that's just because of a takana that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai made, the enactment that he made. And the Mishnah here tells us why we do it. Zecher lemikdash is a remembrance in memory of the mikdash. Right, and this word zecher, remember, is going to be a key word throughout this whole chapter. So remember the word remember. So I remember the joyous, right? Sukkot is a joyous holiday. I remember the joyous holiday that I have of Sukkot and how we experience it. I can remember it so well, but then I'm going to recreate that experience outside the Mikdash so I can have that feeling. And then at the end of the Mishnah, it tacks on another decree that he made. Shien Yom Hanef Kulo Asur, that he said the day of waving will be entirely prohibited. And I'm going to explain what this is because it's a little bit complicated. I'm going to do it quickly. Bear with me. Okay, the day of waving is referring to the Omer, the first opening of the spring harvest with the barley harvest. And up until that period, it's springtime. The barley waving offering happens on the second day of Pesach, on the 16th of Nisan. And up in the verse in Leviticus, Vayikra 23:14, which discusses it, says, up until you do the wave offering in the temple, you are not allowed to eat from the new produce of this harvest. And that wave offering is sort of the banner breaker, and allows the new harvest to be consumed. Okay? And that usually happens on the 16th of Nisan, the second day of Pesach. And if you remember the Omer, that we're going to continue to count the Omer for 7 weeks. On the 50th day is going to be Chag HaShavuot, and then we're going to give the wheat offering of the Shtei Alechem, and that sort of encompasses the new harvest period. Now, what is the decree that he did? The verse in Leviticus that I quoted for you says that it's forbidden to eat from the new grain, and then the verse has a funny formulation. It says, ad etzem hayom hazeh, until this very day, ad haviyachem et omer, et korban haomer. I don't have it in front of me exactly, something like that. Until you bring the omer offering, this wave offering that the Kohen is going to do. And so it says until, and there are two different untils. And the understanding is that in the time when the temple is standing, you're not allowed to eat from the new produce until the Kohen does this wave offering in the Mikdash, in the temple. But the Pesach itself has built into it what should happen when there is no temple. If there is no temple, the essence of the day, when it becomes light on the morning of the 16th, earlier in the day than when the wave offering would happen, you're allowed to eat from the new grain. So the Torah actually sets up what to do. How do I eat if I don't have a temple? But the decree of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he said, no. Instead of letting you eat on the morning of the 16th, the whole day is going to be forbidden to you to eat the new grain. And you can only eat the new grain on the morning of the 17th. All right. So here what's interesting is, and the Gemara asks why. And the Gemara says, well, hopefully the whole day, maybe the temple will be rebuilt. And if the temple is rebuilt, then I'm only going to be able to eat it with the wave offering. We don't want anyone to say, well, like, oh, last year we ate for the morning, and now I'm going to eat for the morning again. And pitom, boom, meharayi b'nei beit hamikdash. Quickly, the beit hamikdash will be built. So, in fact, of the whole day of the 16th, I have to wait with anticipation. Maybe the temple will be rebuilt. Maybe it will be rebuilt. I'm only going to be able to eat tomorrow. And so here I kind of have the opposite experience that I had with Sukkot, right? Sukkot was, I've lost something when the temple has been destroyed, celebrating for 7 days, and I'm going to recreate that experience to remember the temple so I can do what I did in the temple. Here, I'm in a worse situation. If the temple was built, I would be able to eat from the new grain earlier. And if, in theory, according to Torah law, I should be able to eat from the new grain earlier, and the decree is to, like, make me wait and not do an action, by doing a non-action, I feel the loss of the Mikdash, I feel the loss of the temple, and I have the hope that it will be rebuilt. What's interesting about this Mishnah is we now have gone, this Mishnah also appears in Masechet Sukkah, word for word, chapter 3:12. And so we have to sort of ask ourselves, like, why put it in two places, right? If the goal of the Mishnah was to just give us the information of what to do, I have that information. I got it in Tractate Sukkah. I don't need to repeat it. What is bringing it here in these decrees about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and sort of in this discussion of how the Jewish people revived itself mechadeshed itself, renewed itself post-temple destruction. What does it add for us? So the first thing that it adds for us is, if you see, it gives a flow of all the holidays, right? I now have Sukkot. Yom HaNef, the day of waving, links me from Pesach to Shavuot, right? And I've already mentioned Shabbat. I've already mentioned Rosh Hashanah, right? If you remember back to the chapter one of the whole purpose of some of the decrees that were made was the Takanat HaMoadot, right? The affixing of the holidays. Here, too, I have the whole holiday festival. And one of the discussions we said is being happening in this chapter is about the holiness of time. And so, of course, I want to tell you the whole holiness, the whole holiday cycle, because that's reflected in the holiness of time. So that's thing number one that's interesting about this Mishnah. Thing number two that's interesting about this Mishnah, if we go to our model that we said of like looking for the behind the scenes of what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was thinking when he made his decrees, what's interesting to me about these two examples of the lulav and the wave offering is, I don't know if you know how you shake the lulav, the way you're notel the lulav, the way you take the four species is you shake it, right, in all four directions, right, northeast, southwest, and then up and down. And a wave offering, I tried to research what it means to wave, but the Kohen also does some type of movement of moving the barley sheaf in different directions. So this is interesting to me, because on the one hand, these are both rituals happening in the temple, right? This is temple ritual. And we said maybe the shofar is also temple ritual. And we're talking about taking ritualistic ceremonial things that happen in the temple outside. But these are two temple rituals. And the temple is where the divine presence is concentrated. But these are two rituals that make us point in all directions. Why do we point in all directions? I don't know if you know the Uncle Moishe song. Right, up, up, down, down, left, right, and all around. That's where she can be found. Right, that Hashem is here, Hashem is there, Hashem is truly everywhere. Up, up, down, down, right? The divine is in all directions. The divine is everywhere. So even though we have a concept that the divine is concentrated in the Mikdash, on the other hand, we have symbols in the Mikdash that tells us that really the divine is present everywhere. And so maybe the reason I am being able to celebrate 7 days Lifnei Hashem, before the divine, when the temple was standing, that was in the Mikdash. But when the Mikdash isn't standing, maybe Lifnei Hashem is everywhere. That's what the Lulav teaches me. So here too, these two decrees give us some behind the scenes of possibly what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was thinking when he made these decrees where he wants to expand outwards from the Mikdash. Okay, Mishnah 4, I'm going quickly. Mishnah 4, this is like our key linchpin. At the start, they would accept testimony about the new moon all day long. So now, once again, even though our focus is going to be about Rosh Hashanah in the second chapter, Mishnah Hey 5 is going to talk about the tefillah in Rosh Hashanah, we're back to our Edim. We're back to those witnesses that we saw in chapter 1 and in chapter 2 and in the beginning of chapter 3 who come to sanctify the new moon. So at first, they would accept the testimony about the new moon all day long. Pam achad nishtahu ha'edim milavo, v'nitkalkalu ha'levim b'shir. But one time, the edim were late in coming. They were delayed in coming, right? And this whole idea about them coming and we want to encourage them to come, we saw in chapter 1. And what happened when they were delayed in coming? This is, now we're going to find out, we're at the time period where the temple still stands. It messed up the Levite's song. What does it mean it messed up the Levite's song? Part of the ritual that happens in the temple, besides the sacrifices, is that the Levites sing. And the Levites sing the Shir Shel Yom, the song of the day. We today in our traditional prayer service still do this. And there's a special song that they sing on Sunday and Monday and Tuesday, and a special song that you would sing if it was a holiday. The Levites are the clock of the Mikdash. They're the way you, one of the ways where you tell the time. Obviously, you can tell time. They're constant sacrifices that happen every day, so you're not going to know what the special time is. There are additional sacrifices like the Korban Musaf that happens on Shabbat and holidays and on Rosh Hashanah. But another way to tell time is the song that the Levites do. And the song that the Levites sing, they sing it in the morning, and they sing it with the last possible sacrifice that's offered in the day, the Tamid Shel Bein Harbayim, the Tamid of the constant everyday sacrifice of the evening. Now, apparently, the witnesses were so delayed that they came running. Right? The witnesses can come till nightfall, but I have to do the whole ritual of offering the sacrifice takes me time. So I started that a little bit before nightfall, and I already slaughtered the animal, and I sacrificed it, and the Levim sang, and then the witnesses come, oh, we're here, we're here, we're here, and you might have thought this was the last day of Elul. We're going to find out. We're talking about the Rosh Hashanah. Once again, we have the issue of Kiddush HaChodesh and Rosh Hashanah being linked. But really, they say, by the way, it was really Rosh Hashanah. And now there's not any more ritual to do in the temple to say that today was Rosh Hashanah. It's over. And so even though the witness has come and we sanctified the day, the reality in the temple is that it looked like a weekday, and the song of the Levites was the last possible thing that they could do to make it be Rosh Hashanah. And it got messed up. And this word kilkul means it's spoiled, it's rotten, it's bungled, it's all messed up. And so now we have a mess up in the time period of the temple that needs a fix. V'hikinu shelo yu mekablim ela ad hamincha. And so they made a decree. We don't know. The Beit Din and the time when the temple was standing made a decree that they would only accept the witnesses until the mincha period, right? So this solves the problem, right? You lock the Beit Din door. By the time mincha time comes, mincha is this last offering that happens during the day. I know for sure it's not Rosh Hashanah because the witnesses haven't come and they're not going to be able to come because I'm not accepting witnesses anymore. And then I can easily offer that regular sacrifice and have the Levites sing the regular weekday song, and there'll be no mess up. And I'll know for sure that I didn't mess anything up because remember, it's by the human hands of the human court that turns it into Rosh Hashanah. And since I'm not going to accept the witnesses, it's not going to turn into Rosh Hashanah. Okay, so that's the decree, that we're only going to accept them before Mincha, i.e. if I accept them after Mincha, no deal. So if they come before Mincha, great, I'll sanctify the new day, it will be Rosh Hashanah, and then I can sing the appropriate song, and if there's enough time, I can even offer the appropriate sacrifices. Interestingly enough, it doesn't mention would I blow the shofar or not. That seems to be missing. And then it tells me a little bit more information about this decree. V'im ba'u edim min ha-mincha ulamala, n'hogim oto hayom kodesh ulamachar kodesh. And if they come from Mincha and on, right, like I said, in the temple, they wouldn't accept them. But now I have a view, right? So in the temple, it's purely weekday because the temple has to have objective truth time. But what do I do as the nation, right? And now I learned something very interesting. Already from the night before, I needed, right, this is on the day that is either the 30th day of Elul or the first day of Tishrei. It might be Rosh Hashanah, it might not be Rosh Hashanah. I don't know. If it's Rosh Hashanah, according to the traditional view of the rabbis, I'm not allowed to perform any creative acts. I have to refrain from doing melacha, and I would need to refrain from doing it already from the night. But I'm only going to find out during the day if they sanctify the day. So what I have to do is I'm noheg oto yon kodesh. I act as if, I pretend as if that very day is going to be a holy day. And here we have a new word for Rosh Hashanah. We had a Yom Tov, and now it's called the Yom Kodesh. And then if the witnesses don't come, right, it hits Mincha time, they don't come, I've been pretending the whole day is Rosh Hashanah, I then need to continue and do a Lamachar, and the manuscripts say also the word Yom, Yom Kodesh, and I'll do the next day as Rosh Hashanah, okay? So I was pretending it might be Rosh Hashanah, it might be Rosh Hashanah, because if the witnesses come, then it would be Rosh Hashanah. So I needed to act, I need to know, hey, act as if it was Rosh Hashanah. Now with it, and they could have come all the way till nightfall, so no problem. Up until nightfall, before the decree, I was doing it. And if they didn't come, then obviously the next day would be Rosh Hashanah, and I would treat it with Kedusha. Now that I've made this new decree to help what happens in the Mikdash, in the song, when it hits Mincha time, right, I told you, in the Mikdash, they know for sure that witnesses aren't coming. That's great. But that means me outside the Mikdash, where I've been behaving like it's Kedusha, like it's holiness, also know they're not coming. Now that would be, and I know for 100% that this pretending I'm doing isn't a real thing. It's real pretending. It is pretend. Now, it would be very, very awkward if I would then stop and go back to my weekday activities. That would not be good, right? That would really create a mockery of this noheg acting like it's Kodesh. So part of the decree that was made is that I, even though I know they're not coming because the doors are locked for Mincha time, I continue to behave as if there's holiness the whole day. And then the next day I do holiness, which is the real Rosh Hashanah. Okay. I'm going to stop in the middle of this Mishnah because there's a lot more to say and I don't want to go. I've already gone over time. So we're pausing. This was the first decree that happened when the temple was still standing. We're going to still have the next stage where Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is going to make a decree post-destruction, but we're going to find that out tomorrow.
Thank you to our Pardes faculty, and thank you to you, our learners. Make sure to check back in at the beginning of each week to stay on track with your Elul learning, and visit www.pardes.org.il for more information about Pardes and our programs.